And welcome back to Coast. In a moment, we're going live to the United Kingdom to talk with Marcus Allen about the moon landings and why so many people are skeptical about whether we actually went. Now, tonight's program is not intended to debunk the moon landings, but to talk about why people are skeptical about it. The United States' Apollo 11, for example, was the first crewed mission to land on the moon, and that was July 20th, 1969.
The surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Ground mass is very fine. And now step off the laminate. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The words of Neil Armstrong, the late Neil Armstrong. There were six crewed U.S. landings between 1969 and 1972, but then they all seemed to stop. Why? In a moment, Marcus Allen joins us. I'll tell you about him in just a second on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Marcus Allen is the United Kingdom's publisher of Nexus magazine, which he introduced to the U.K. and Europe in 1994. Nexus magazine is the world's leading alternative news magazine, and it covers health, future science, hidden history, the unexplained, the UFOs as well. Marcus is now able to pursue his lifelong interest in the unexplained on a full-time basis. Now, the moon landings, ancient Egypt, are just a couple of the many taboo subjects he has investigated around, which new questions have been raised that have yet to be adequately answered. Maybe we'll get some of those answers today. Marcus, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, George. It's very good to be here.
How are you and how are things in the United Kingdom?
Well, the sun is apparently coming up, but it's very cloudy here at the moment, so we don't see. It's nice and bright. It's quite cold, but we haven't had the bad weather that I've been seeing is occurring in America at the moment, or certain parts of America. So we're just looking forward to the spring, looking forward to a nice summer. Should be great fun.
We're overdue. Is Prime Minister Boris Johnson going to survive all of this?
Oh, I think he's going to survive all right. It's a great deal. It's a fuss about nothing. There are many more important things going on in the world, in Britain, in the UK. And I think this is a distraction from by people who want to remove him from office.
Yeah, I think
because he's quite successful.
Fascinating subject matter tonight, Marcus. The moon landings being one of them, of course. Tell me about your interest in that.
Well, it started about 25 years ago when I attended a lecture in Glastonbury at something called the Glastonbury Symposium, which is a regular event. And the chap there was talking about megaliths, I think it was, and he was showing a lot of photographs, and he said, almost offhand, he said, of course, those photographs taken on the moon, they're fake, they weren't taken on the moon. And I thought, what's he talking about? Because I'm old enough to have been around when the moon landings happened.
Sure.
In 1969. And I remember I stayed up till 3 a.m. and watched them. I watched Neil Armstrong take his one small step. I thought, this is a wonderful event. What an incredible achievement.
It was exciting, grainy black and white television, but it was great, wasn't it?
It was, yes. It was very exciting. And millions of people watched it, and we all saw the same thing, and we were all very excited about it. And for 20 years, I thought, this is great. America has achieved what it set out to do. President Kennedy said, go to the moon before the end of the decade, and his command, his direction had been fulfilled. I thought, wow, America is really doing very well. And that's what I believed for 20 or 30 years, as did many other people. I mean, we had no reason not to believe it, because there was no stories about things, strange things happening. There was none of that. The 400,000 people worked for Apollo, and they were very proud of what they'd done because they could see the result of
sure.
it on television. And you know, they weren't involved in any sort of deception or anything like that. No, they were doing the very best job they could. And right across America, from Washington State, where Boeing is based, to New York, where Grumman is based, Lockheed down in California and the command center at Houston, the launch site in Florida. You know, it's right across America. It was one of the major objectives of the Apollo program was to provide employment for as many states as possible. And I think there was a total of 49 states were involved altogether. So it was a big American venture, a big American endeavor. And there, live on television, we saw it for real.
That's right.
And I thought, wow, incredible. What an achievement. I'm sure we'll be seeing moon bases any time now. They'll probably go to Mars by the end of the century. This is 1969. The end of the century is only 31 years away. And they could get to Mars. They could do all sorts of things. And looking forward to seeing all that. The trouble is, none of it happened.
You don't believe that?
It's not a matter of belief, really. It's a matter of evidence. With many things, I was trained as a photographer in London in the 60s, which was great fun. So I knew what cameras could and couldn't do. I knew what film could and couldn't record.
Right.
And of course, one should remember that there are many people probably listening now who've never used photographic film in a camera. They've only used digital. So they're probably not familiar with the restrictions and the excitement of using photographic film.
I remember the old 35-millimeter capsules you'd drop into your camera and click it in there, and you'd have to wind it up and everything else. Remember those days?
Oh, yes. Yes, I remember. I've used those sort of cameras. In fact, that was what I was trained to use. My purpose in going to photographic college was to find out about the technical side of photography, not so much what to take. That would occur as one wandered around with a camera, because I'd traveled to India and taken a lot of photographs out there. So I was excited about photography. And at the time, it was all film cameras. There was no digital cameras. They weren't developed until the mid-1970s. So using photographic film, there are certain problems with it. And because I was familiar with it, I was able to look at the photographs. If you can read a photograph, you can see where the lights were placed. You can see what type of lens the photographer was using, mm-hmm. the depth of field. You can see many things. And if you're familiar with the technical side of photography, you can then make decisions about photographs. Because that's the whole purpose of photography, is to ensure that you get what you're seeing with your eyes onto the photographic film.
But it's not the photography alone that has got you convinced that we didn't go.
No, it was about 3 years ago. I attended a talk in London given by an American. His name was Phil Pressel. And he was one of the developers of the camera equipment that was used on the Hexagon Reconnaissance Satellite, or spy satellite. And he was describing, he's very proud of what he'd done. He'd retired by this time, and the Hexagon spy satellite, known as KH-9, Keyhole 9, was launched in 1970, basically to spy on Russia. And it was launched into a polar orbit, and it went around the Earth, and it photographed the things that it passed over. And that was a great advance in information. Now, when Phil was talking about his creating the photographic equipment to go onto the spy satellite, mm-hmm. he said, almost in passing, he said, of course, the film had to be pressurized. I thought, what's he talking about? I never heard a film had to be pressurized in space. And at the end of the talk, I asked him, I said, would this pressurization of photographic film be required on Apollo? He said, of course it would. Photographic film cannot survive in the vacuum of space. It must be under a small amount of pressure. In the case of the Hexagon, it was under 1 pound per square inch of pressure. which was maintained by a nitrogen gas bottle.
Without the pressure, the pictures would not appear on the film, I assume.
Well, the pictures may appear on the film, but the film itself wouldn't survive, because film is basically a plastic backing which is coated with gelatin, a gelatin emulsion,
right,
which is light sensitive. And that is what the photograph is taken with, this light sensitive emulsion. Now, because the emulsion started life as a liquid, and though it's, when it goes on to the photographic film, it is obviously dried, but it's still affected by the vacuum of space. What it does, it's, the technical term for it is outgassing. The lighter elements in any liquid will be removed by the vacuum. I'm sure many people have done the test where you get a little vacuum chamber in the school physics laboratory, and you remove the air from inside it, or some of it, and if you put a bowl of water into it, it'll start to boil. Technically, that's called outgassing. And that's what a vacuum does. It removes matter from liquid. It removes the lighter elements, the hydrogen and the helium. It removes those first. And so I thought, well, if vacuum affects photographic film, and you have to keep the film under a degree of a small amount of pressure, but pressure nevertheless, where was the pressure on the Apollo cameras, the Hasselblad?
I don't think there was any.
No, there wasn't, because you can see there are many photographs showing the Hasselblad cameras on the lunar surface. They're carried by the astronauts on their chest. And there's no pressurization, because if there was, it would be very obvious. The camera would be surrounded by a container, and there would be a gas bottle that would provide the pressure. That didn't occur on Apollo. And I thought, well, if you need pressurization to keep photographic film, to keep the integrity of photographic film, how are all these photographs taken? Because I've seen there are 5,771 photographs taken on the lunar surface by the 12 named astronauts over the six missions, which is quite a lot.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Not all the photographs are particularly good. Some are out of focus. Some don't show anything of particular interest. It's referred to in the...
Some look pretty good.
Yeah, some of them are excellent. I'd be very proud to have taken some of the photographs. There are probably 100, maybe 200 really good photographs. And when you look at those are the ones that most people are familiar with. Probably the most familiar one of all is the one of Buzz Aldrin, Man on the Moon, with Neil Armstrong reflected in his visor.
Exactly. I thought, gorgeous picture.
Incredible. Amazing pictures. But if you need photographic film to be kept under pressure in a vacuum, because I think we can all agree that there is a vacuum at the moon, and vacuum levels are quite severe at the moon. They do vary. Here on Earth, we don't experience vacuums very much because we live under 14.7 pounds per square inch of atmospheric pressure. That's the weight of the air above us, all around us, but we don't feel it.
Well, Marcus, what about all the rocks they brought back, 700 pounds worth?
Yes. Have you seen any?
Personally, no, I have not.
Well, I've got one. I've got a nice moon rock here.
Does it look like a moon rock?
It's about 100 grams, 3 or 4 ounces. That's what most people think a moon rock is.
Is it about like an inch by an inch and a half, something like that?
That's right. Yeah, that's what most people would assume it. Now, after Apollo, President Nixon presented every American state and every foreign country with a piece of moon rock. I'm thinking, oh, that's generous. And There's one in the Science Museum here in London. That's where the UK's present is kept. I went to have a look at it. And it's basically a large lump of plastic which encases three small grains of dust. So you can't get close to it. I mean, you can look at it, you
right.
can see it, but I doubt that you could do very much experimentation on it. But we're told that the moon rock has been investigated by many, many people, and it's been compared to the Russian rock, because they brought 300 grams back. America brought 842 pounds back. So there's a considerable difference in the size. So you say, well, of course they got all the moon rock. But how do we know where it came from?
Well, we really
You've probably seen the quite famous photograph of Wernher von Braun and his companions in Antarctica in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
What on earth was he doing in Antarctica?
Was he collecting rocks?
He was collecting rocks, because you could see them in Antarctica. Rocks are normally quite dark in color, and Antarctica is very white, so they stand out quite well against the white background.
Well, let me ask you this, Marcus. I mean, we beat the Russians to the moon, apparently. If this was all hoaxed, don't you think they would have said something about it and denied it and said, you Americans never went. You didn't go to the moon. These six crews that went there of two each, you never went. But they never said that.
No, you're quite right. They didn't say that, because they didn't have any more information about what was going on than we all did. They were watching the same television pictures. But what is interesting is that since the Apollo moon landings, and because of the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, Soviet or Russian now, we should refer to them as Russians, not Soviets,
yeah.
Russian scientists, filmmakers, have been able to access the Apollo record, as we all can. We can go online and we can download and read the reports, we can see the photographs, they're all online. The site I use is the Lunar and Planetary Institute website, because I just like the way it's laid out. So the Russians would have been able to access all the information, which they have done. And there are considerable number of reports from very highly qualified Russian scientists and filmmakers, people whose life has been, and they've examined the Apollo record, and they question it, and they say, how did this happen? They say, how did the Saturn V rocket do what we're told it did?
You're not saying that we never launched these people, these astronauts.
Of course. No, because for Apollo 11, a million people were at Cocoa Beach to watch it.
We all watched it, that's right. And over the course of the six missions, 18 astronauts went up there.
That's right. They did. Well, more than that, because don't forget Apollo 13, which didn't land.
But they all had three in there.
Yeah, they all had three in it. Two went on to the lunar surface.
And one stayed
with the command module.
That's right. 18 total.
Well, there was Apollo 8 and Apollo 10, which were test missions.
Hold on for a second, Marcus. We're at a break. We'll come back and pick it up and find out why more people believe we did not go to the moon. And welcome back to Coast, George Dory with you, Marcus Allen with us. Marcus, his websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. He's the United Kingdom publisher of Nexus magazine, and we're talking about the skeptics and going to the moon. So we've talked about the rocks, Marcus. We've talked about the Russians not saying anything. We talked about some of the film. What else is out there that got you convinced that we didn't go there?
It's basically the information that's contained within the Apollo record, the lack of information in certain areas, the point that I made about vacuum levels destroying photographic film persuades me that There are questions still to be answered. NASA have been approached. I've approached them. I've asked them, in fact, I was asking them about the protection that the spacesuits would offer against radiation. I said, well, could these spacesuits be used to technicians to go into nuclear reactors like Fukushima or Three Mile Island or Chernobyl over in Ukraine? Could they be used because they protected the astronauts against the radiation in space? And we know there's radiation in space.
Sure.
And they said, well, the manufacturer of the spacesuit, which is the people I approached, said, you better direct your question to NASA because we just created the spacesuits according to their specification. They told us what to build, and we built them, or we made them. So I approached NASA and asked that question, and I'm still waiting for the reply.
If they ever do reply, they may not. Now, I knew Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell. He apparently went to the moon. I don't think he was lying to me, Marcus, but your thoughts?
That's a question that would be appropriate for every astronaut. You've probably seen the famous film that Bart Sibrel made about approaching the Apollo astronauts.
Oh, absolutely. But Buzz Aldrin took a swipe at him, didn't he?
Yes, it was Buzz Aldrin. Well, quite right, too. As Bart said, I was way out of order on that. He was a much older gentleman than I was. I shouldn't have approached him in that way, and he apologized to him. But the point about it is that, as I understand it, maybe you can correct me if I'm incorrect on this, that if somebody is seen to swear an oath on a Bible, that is taken or can be taken as a legal admission, and it can be used in court. Now, I don't know if that's correct or not.
I think only in court. I think it has to be in court in order to do that.
So it has to be in court. But it was rather informative that only three astronauts were prepared to swear on the Bible that they had walked on the lunar surface.
Well, I think the argument for those astronauts who would not do that was they felt it was offensive to them when they went there.
Yes, I can quite understand that, because to have one of the major events of your life being questioned,
right,
would be very uncomfortable.
Especially when you risked your life to get there.
Exactly. Because this is a very dangerous undertaking. I mean, it is still today. We all saw those rockets take off. We saw them on television, or a million people watched Apollo 11 take off. There were less people at subsequent launches, but there were still hundreds of thousands of people. So there's no doubt that the rocket took off. But 2 minutes after it was launched, it disappears from sight. So because it's 50 miles downrange, it's moving quite fast,
sure,
and it's up in space. So people on Earth can't see it. You know, it's like trying to see an aeroplane. You can see when an aeroplane is flying because of the contrails behind it. So you look at the front of it and you think, well, where's the plane? And this is only 6 miles up, 30,000 feet or so, height of Mount Everest. And something the size of a jumbo jet, which is quite a large piece of kit, it's just invisible unless you use binoculars. So a rocket that's 50 miles up is not going to be visible to anybody on Earth. And we have to rely on NASA to tell us what's going to happen next. And they told us in interminable detail what happened next. Every word spoken on the spacecraft was recorded. We were told where it was going. Well, it was going to the moon, obviously, but we're on its way. It takes 3 days to reach the moon from Earth because even though it launches at 25,000 miles an hour, that's escape velocity from Earth.
So with these missions, Marcus, what do you think happened? They were launched, they went to the moon, they went around the moon, but they just never landed?
Well, that's an interesting question, because if one takes the view, as I do, and as quite a few other people do as well, that getting to the moon is not really very much of a problem using equipment that was even available back in the 1960s. It was done first by the Soviets in 1959. They got a rocket to the moon. Now, getting humans to the moon and back again alive, that is a very, very different matter, because even launching, it's a very exciting event to watch. I mean, it's a huge thing, this rocket. When you come back from the moon, let's say that you got to the moon, if you come back from the moon, you have to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. The problem is that you're re-entering the Earth's atmosphere at the same speed you left it at, because gravitational attraction accelerates anything coming towards Earth. If you enter the Earth's atmosphere at 25,000 miles an hour, you've got to slow down. And spacecraft don't have brakes. So you've got to use the frictional forces of the atmosphere to remove the kinetic energy, the speed of the spacecraft. And that requires a heat shield. And the heat shield obviously worked on Apollo, because all spacecraft came back. Now, in 2014, December 2014, the first launch was made of the Orion spacecraft. That's Apollo 2.0. That's the new craft which is going to be used to send humans back to the moon, directed by President Trump in 2019. When it had its first test in December 2014, the Orion spacecraft, it almost destroyed its heat shield. In fact, it was so much of a problem that it had to be completely redesigned, and that's what's happening now. That's why we haven't seen any more launches of the Orion spacecraft.
What about the temperature, Marcus, on the surface of the moon? How high did that get?
Right. Good point. On the surface of the moon, the temperature in sunlight is 120 degrees centigrade. Higher than the boiling point of water. In the shade, it is minus 120 degrees centigrade.
Wow.
Colder than any temperature here on Earth. Lowest temperature on Earth is minus 80 in Antarctica and in Siberia. So these are very extremes of temperature, which humans have to be protected against, because humans can't survive those temperatures. But because vacuum is a very good insulator, there's only one way to remove heat from an astronaut, and that is radiation. You can't convect it away. You can't use air conditioning, because there's no way to dump the heat. You can't dump heat into a vacuum. So we're told that there was water being circulated inside their spacesuit to remove the heat. Well, how was that done if radiation of heat is the only way to remove it? And if you use something called the black body radiation temperature, which involves the Stefan-Boltzmann constant, sorry, getting a bit technical here, but don't worry, bear with me.
I shall.
Using the Stefan-Boltzmann constant, you can calculate the internal temperature of a spacecraft. And using that information, and any mathematician will be able to do it quite easily, the answer is 240 degrees Fahrenheit, or 120 degrees centigrade.
God,
that is the internal temperature.
The equipment would burn up. The astronauts would burn up. Nobody could live in that.
Exactly. This is the point. When you start looking into the science of space travel, and we've already mentioned vacuum, and that is a known physical event, heat is the same. If heat is... And the heat comes from the sun. It's the radiant energy of the sun. That's what we experience here on Earth, which is why the Earth is not a floating snowball, because it absorbs heat. And it also emits heat, which is why the temperature is fairly constant, because the amount of energy coming in is equal by the amount of energy being radiated away. Now, the same thing would apply to a spacecraft. If you put a spacecraft into space, it's going to be in the sun. It's going to be affected by solar radiation. Not just the bad stuff, which we'll maybe come to in a minute, but just the radiant energy of the sun. We experience it here on Earth. Everybody knows what radiant energy is. But you get it in space as well. And the point about that is that you've got to remove it. It's got to be kept at a constant temperature. And we're told how it was done with on the Apollo spacecraft. They were using water, which if you put water into a vacuum, it will release heat. So you've got a means of doing it. But the description of it on the Apollo spacecraft is so implausible that it could actually operate the way we're told it did, that I tend to ask more questions, which is, well, how did it work? And I've not had proper answers on that.
And let me ask you this, Marcus. The big question is, why fake it? What's the motive here?
Okay. That's probably the key question, actually.
Absolutely.
Why fake it? Somewhere in the mid-1960s, there was definitely Apollo was set up to succeed. It was being run by the U.S. Air Force. They were called in when things started getting a bit difficult.
Touchy.
And then in the mid-1960s, they knew enough. The people at NASA and the other contractors, there were 400,000 people involved in Apollo in the mid-1960s. They were trying to do the very best job they could, but they knew more than they had when they started that it was actually very, very difficult. Because getting into space, though it looks quite easy when you see these rockets taking off, it's what happens next that's the major problem. They'd already launched the Mercury program, that's one man in space. They had the Gemini program, that's two men in space. So they were all in low Earth orbit, i.e. about 200 miles up. They knew that going to the moon was a completely different ballgame, to coin a phrase. They knew that there were enough problems to be overcome, not least of which is getting there, but even more problems in getting back, getting humans back alive, that it was becoming almost impossible to agree that they could meet President Kennedy's challenge to get to the moon by the end of the decade. But because they had to be seen to do it, they made one monumental error.
What was that?
They said, we're going to show it live on television, which are the pictures we all watched. How on earth do you get a live television picture from the moon, 240,000 miles away, back to Earth? The average TV transmitter on Earth will transmit over about 60 miles.
And we didn't have relay satellites at the time, did we?
Exactly. We didn't have the technology we have today. Now we can do it easily. We can transmit television pictures from anywhere in the world,
sure.
Received anywhere.
We can do it with our phones.
Exactly, we do it on the phones. But we didn't have that sort of technology in the 1960s. So there would have been a decision made at quite a high level. We would probably involve the president. And don't forget that by this time, the president is Lyndon Johnson, who had taken over from Kennedy, if you remember the assassination and the swearing-in of the vice president.
And then it was Nixon when we landed on the moon.
And Nixon managed to take all the credit for it. And you think back to the election in 1960 where Nixon and Kennedy were up against each other.
Well, tens of thousands of people, Marcus, worked on the program. Did they all keep this as a secret? All of them?
Of course they didn't. No, not one of them did, because they weren't told anything.
The people in mission control, how did they not know that we weren't there on the moon? They were in the room. They were monitoring this thing. They were in communications. How did they get tricked or duped?
But they weren't tricked. They weren't tricked at all. If you remember, Gene Kranz, who was the...
He was the NASA mission director.
Yes. He was working at Houston. He was in charge of making sure that everything worked well. He was the sort of head controller. And to practice for the missions, what they did was create simulated events.
Let's talk more about the simulation and the people involved and how they may have kept a secret if they did. And then we'll take some phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.